This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is Why Bypass Surgery and Stents Usually Do More Harm Than Good, with guest Dr. Michael Osner. Major research studies show that bypass surgery and stents don't prevent heart attacks or death any more than conservative medical treatment. Nevertheless, 1 million Americans a year get angioplasties and 500,000 have bypass surgeries. Today, Dr. Michael Osner, author of The Great American Heart Hoax, tells you what your cardiologist isn't telling you about heart disease and heart health. Dr. Osner, welcome.
Thank you very much.
You're kind of the Ralph Nader of cardiology.
Well, I'm a cardiologist who believes that the majority of men and women in the United States would be best served by following a prevention program, a prevention course. Instead, we subject literally millions of patients to intervention, stents, and bypass surgery. And I think that indeed is the hoax, because we really don't have the scientific basis to do a lot of the intervention that we're doing in the United States. I must point out at the very outset, it's not that at all that I'm against intervention. I think putting in a stent in a patient in the throes of a heart attack has been shown to not only be worthwhile, it can indeed be life-saving. Doing bypass surgery in a patient who's unstable, again, it could be life-saving. So it's not the use of intervention, whether it be catheter-based or scalpel-based, that I'm opposed to. It's the inappropriate use of these procedures in stable individuals who happen to have a blockage in their arteries.
You say there are three major studies that are very well done that compared conservative treatment with bypass surgery head-to-head, and what did they find?
Well, these were landmark trials performed in the 1970s, and the first was the Veterans Administration, or VA study, which at the end of the study, it showed really no benefit of performing bypass surgery compared to those patients treated in a conservative fashion without surgery. There was no prolongation of life. There was no prevention of future heart attacks. After that study, there was another study published called the Coronary Artery Surgery Study, or CAS trial, which again showed no benefit of bypass surgery over conservative medical therapy and lifestyle approach. And then the third study was a major European trial called the European CAS or EuroCAS trial, which again failed to show benefit of bypass surgery. In fact, in that trial, bypass surgery was associated with an increased risk of death compared to a conservative approach.
And all three of these were well-designed studies, peer-reviewed, published in major medical journals.
That's correct.
I suspect it's hard to get people to fund these. Probably the people most likely to fund it would be the government, since they pay a lot of bills, and insurance companies. Have there been other well-designed studies that contradict these studies?
Really, there haven't been, and I think that's been the problem. We know that certainly we like to practice evidence-based medicine as physicians. And again, I think that what we understand is that, and it must be pointed out, again, in these trials, we're talking about stable patients with coronary artery disease. Then stable patients need to be defined. We're not talking about individuals, men or women, in the throes of a heart attack. We're not talking about patients who have severe disabling chest pain. They can't walk 10 feet without having to pop a nitroglycerin. We're talking about people who may have what we call angina, which is exertional chest discomfort, but they're otherwise stable. They're in our office. They're clearly not in the emergency room with crushing chest pain. And I think that is a major distinction, because in the stable population, we clearly know, whether it's surgery or the catheter-based trials, we know that a lifestyle intervention along with medical therapy is clearly the approach we should be taking.
So an important distinction in considering what you advocate is, are you a stable patient or are you in some kind of crisis or barely functioning because of cardiac problems?
That's right. And I think that distinction really needs to be made. And I think that, let me also point out that the major studies looking at whether or not stents or what we call angioplasty, which is initially started with balloon angioplasty. It was a catheter, which is a long thin tube, put on the end of a catheter, and the balloon would be inflated and thereby displacing the blockage. These trials initially were introduced with a lot of fanfare and hype that this was really going to make a major dent in preventing heart attacks and prolonging life, and they really failed to do that, again, in the stable population. And one of the first trials that looked at this was the AVERT trial, which found it really took patients who had, some of these patients had severe blockages in their arteries, and compared opening up the artery with a balloon versus putting them on a high-dose statin and medical therapy. And at the end of the trial, the patients treated medically actually fared better than those treated with balloon angioplasty. Well, then the critics said, well, that's great for balloons, but we now have stents, and stents are so much better. Well, then the stent trials came out, and this was one of the landmark stent trials was the COURAGE trial, which, again, showed no incremental benefit of putting in a stent beyond optimal medical therapy, which included lifestyle intervention along with medications as indicated.
Again, we have some major studies that are well-designed, well-reviewed, and published in major medical journals that find that it's not offering any additional benefit. Is there any contradictory research?
No, not really. In fact, I will say that to many physicians, as well as to the lay public, they're surprised at these findings because intuitively we would have thought that putting in a bypass has to result in clinical benefit, either prolongation of life or prevention of future heart attacks, and the same with stents and angioplasty. The problem is that we really didn't understand what we term the vascular biology of what causes a heart attack in the first place. Those concepts have changed, because initially we thought that heart attacks were the result of a progressive buildup of sludge in our arteries.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like what we have in our plumbing pipes at our house, where you develop a progressive buildup of sludge and you call the plumber with his Roto-Rooter and he comes out and he unclogs your pipes. Well, what we've learned is that our arteries are not PVC pipes. They're much more dynamic than that. And what we've also learned is that the majority of what we term atherosclerotic plaque, which are like pimples in the artery wall, the majority of these plaques that rupture and lead to heart attacks, believe it or not, are not the 90% blockages that we used to think.
Mm-hmm.
They're the little 10% blockages. It's the small blockages that are highly inflamed that are much more likely to rupture and lead to a sudden and often catastrophic heart attack, or even worse, sudden cardiac death. That really is the problem. The mechanism by which these plaques led to heart attacks, that has really changed dramatically. A lot of the pioneering work was done in Boston and other institutions around the country. But the fact of the matter is, what we now understand is that it's inflammation that drives this process. Yes, it's the cholesterol buildup that initially cholesterol particles move into the artery wall and they get oxidized.
Mm-hmm.
And once they get oxidized, our body's own defense mechanism recognizes these oxidized particles as foreign invaders, and they attack them. They attack them with inflammatory cells, which, like sharks sensing blood, they go into the artery wall and they engulf these oxidized particles, and then they destroy them. But in the process of doing that, these inflammatory cells secrete these very noxious substances that we call proteinases that break down the lining of the plaque the fibrous cap that walls off these oxidized cholesterol particles. And when it finally ruptures, these plaques rupture, blood comes into contact with a plaque, and we develop a sudden clot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this clot that forms then can take you from a 10% blockage to 100% blockage in a matter of seconds. That's why the majority of people who develop heart attacks have no prior warning, or people who with sudden cardiac death have no prior warning, because you're not going to get any prior warning with a 10%, 5%, 1% blockage,
mm-hmm.
as you would, for instance, a person who has a 90%, 95% blockage will start developing some chest tightness when they walk. We understand that. What we know is that inflammation is driving this process, and if true that the majority of plaques that suddenly rupture are tiny little plaques, then from by understanding the biology of what's going on, we now understand why a bypass or a stent and a stable person who happens to have a 90% blockage is not going to help, because that person's most likely, if he does have a heart attack, to have a heart attack in one of those little small blockages or plaques that line the artery wall. It makes much more sense to quiet down the flames of inflammation, and we could talk about how we do that, as well as lowering cholesterol with lifestyle intervention and medical therapy as needed, because that's the approach that will treat all plaques, large and small, and lead to a decrease in the risk of heart attack or sudden cardiac death.
And I want to go into more detail about that, but let me back up with one more question about the research. Just to be fair, is it possible that the people who got the conservative treatment were more conscientious about diet and exercise than the people who got the surgeries?
That's a very good question, and interestingly, the COURAGE trial addressed that issue, because instead of saying in the COURAGE trial, we're going to treat one group with diet and exercise and medical therapy, and the other group we're going to put in stents, what that study proceeded to do was to treat all patients with diet and exercise and medical therapy. So everybody got randomized into the program of lifestyle intervention. After doing that, they then took half of the patients and put a stent in to open up the artery, and the other half just continued with diet and exercise and medication. So they factored in that question mm-hmm. that you're asking, whether or not it's simply diet and exercise. What we really want to know, was there any incremental benefit? Patients ask the question, is it worth taking the risk of putting in these procedures or undergoing bypass surgery? And let's not forget, let's talk about risk for a second. These procedures are not without risk. We know that for bypass surgery, there's up to 5% that a patient may not even make it through the procedure, the intraoperative mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention the fact that you could have a stroke, you could have infection, you can have bleeding. Certainly, there's cognitive problems. People have memory deficits after the procedure.
Right.
There's a whole laundry list of adverse events that can occur, as there is with stent insertion as well. The artery certainly can shut down. Patients who get a lot of the stents today, the so-called coated stents, have to be on blood thinners for the rest of their life. So, again, I'm not saying that these procedures never should be done. There are certainly indications for unstable patients that we need to proceed to towards intervention. But I wrote the Great American Heart Hoax because I really wanted to get the message out that these procedures are not for every Tom, Dick, and Harry, or Mary, Jane, and Susan, who's walking down the street perfectly stable, however, has a blockage. There is a better approach for these individuals.
And a lot of the cardiologists say, well, the angiogram really is a very low-risk procedure, but once you do the angiogram, there's no point in doing it if you're not going to act on the results. So if you turn around and put in a stent, then you're getting into more serious risk. And I especially don't like having to be on blood thinners the rest of your life just because you had the stent.
Well, you know, you bring up a very good point. It's often said that what's a minor procedure? A minor procedure is a procedure being performed on somebody else. What we know about a lot of these procedures, like angiography, which is, oh, gee, let's just go in there and do a cardiac catheterization and see if you have blockages. Let's just do a 64-slice CT, these CAT scans, to see if you have a blockage. Well, I say that one of the major problems with these procedures, beyond the fact that there's an expense, there's a risk of these procedures, and in the area of CT scanning, as well as angiography, there's radiation exposure to the patient. There's no dose of radiation that's safe that increases your risk of cancer. We could talk about that, because that's a major problem in the United States, the proliferation of all these CAT scans in perfectly healthy individuals. But there's another risk, and that is a lot of these procedures, these diagnostic tests, do nothing but shove the patient down that slippery slope leading to more and more unnecessary intervention. And that has to be factored into the equation. If it hasn't been shown in a stable individual that performing the bypass operation or putting in the stent is going to prevent a future heart attack or prolong life, then why start going on a hunt to look for these procedures? Why not take patients and say, hey, we have an approach that whether you have a blockage or you're at risk for a blockage, we have an approach that could keep you from developing these plaques, keep you from developing heart attacks. And it's what I've outlined in part two of my book, The Solution.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 10-step approach that I've been utilizing for 20 years. And it really is an approach that, in my opinion, why wouldn't we want to take men and women in this country and put them through a program that helps to prevent the process to begin with? And for those individuals that have blockages, it could serve to help to reverse the process, stabilize the plaques, and actually reduce the size of the plaques, decrease the inflammation within the plaques, decrease the size of the plaques by lowering cholesterol levels.
Mm-hmm.
This is the approach that makes the most sense for me. And let's reserve intervention for those patients that fall through the cracks, that truly are unstable, that would benefit from an interventional approach.
One of the things I got from your book is that I had this impression that there was kind of an evolution for heart patients, but I thought, well, maybe it's just a small sample or something. But it appears that what often happens, not always, is the doctor says you need bypass surgery and you're scared. And so you do whatever the doctor says. And then the doctor says you need an annual stress test and maybe a nuclear test. And before long, it's you need a stent. And after three or four procedures, people start saying, I thought the bypass surgery was going to cure everything, and here I am on this treadmill. I don't seem to be getting better or ending these surgeries, and they start getting depressed and discouraged and blame themselves and wonder if they're going to die any minute, and it's not a good scenario.
You bring up an excellent point, because we understand that many patients are told that they are walking time bombs. I can't tell you how many times I've seen patients who were told they were walking time bombs, and indeed, they've had little to no symptoms. They happen to have a blockage. I put them into my prevention program, and lo and behold, in one case, 25 years later, the patient's still doing well. In fact, an interesting study was performed at Harvard Medical School by Thomas Grabois, where he took people that were told that they needed an angiogram, and he took another set of people who were told they needed bypass surgery, and he saw them in second opinion and concluded that the vast majority, over 85% of these individuals, indeed did not need a heart catheterization. After he reviewed all the records, did not need to have a bypass operation. Now, those that followed his advice were alive and well years later. And this was published in one of our most reputable medical journals. So we have the data to know that, first and foremost, that bypass surgery or putting in a stent is not a fix. It's not a cure. This term fix is used quite often, and I object to it, because patients are often told that you've got a blockage in your artery, and we're going to fix you in the morning. We're going to do a bypass operation on you, and you'll be fixed. We're going to put in a stent, and you'll be fixed. Clearly, that's not true. We know that this entire disease that we call atherosclerosis, this buildup of plaque and buildup of inflammation that is a result of oxidation of the cholesterol particles, is a metabolic disorder. And it requires a metabolic, not a mechanical solution. So that unless the person changes what got them there in the first place, he's going to be back, or she's going to be back for more stents, more bypass operations. It's what I call the Roach Motel. Once you check in, you don't check out. And I think that that's wrong. We fix patients who, for instance, present to the hospital with acute appendicitis. When we do the appendectomy on Joe and we're wheeling Joe out the door, we could say, Joe, we've cured you. We fixed you. You will never come back to the hospital with acute appendicitis. Why? Because your appendix is in the pickle jar. We can't say that to Joe when we're wheeling him out of the hospital after his triple bypass. Because unless Joe changes the very factors that got him there in the first place, he'll be back. And I think that's where we fumbled the football in this country. We have not emphasized the powerful role that prevention plays in preventing this process from the get-go, or reversing the process in individuals who have blockages. That's why in part two of the book, I talk about my 10-step approach that leads to not only stabilization of plaques for those people that have blockages, but reversal plaque in the other direction, shrinking the plaque size down, opening up the artery. We also know that this is well-suited for people who have risk factors for heart disease. And there's many people that have risk factors for heart disease who want to prevent the problem to begin with. Well, why not follow a very healthy and delicious diet that's been around for thousands of years called the Mediterranean diet? We have mounds of information and clinical trials to show that a Mediterranean-style diet helps to reverse the process. Now, why is that? How can a diet reverse the process? Because the fact of the matter is that what we consume in the United States is what I call the toxic American diet. And it's toxic because it's highly processed. It's highly processed with trans fats. It's highly processed with refined sugar. It's highly processed with sodium. And I could go on and on. It's like taking a gasoline-powered car and putting diesel fuel into the car. That car is not going to function well and will break down. We're putting the wrong kind of fuel into our system. This highly processed food we were never designed to consume, and as hunter-gatherers, we were designed to eat whole foods, fresh fruits and vegetables, whole grains, nuts, beans, which provide soluble and insoluble fiber, cold water fish, bringing omega-3 fat to the table. This is the kind of diet that leads to not only a reduction of cholesterol, but very importantly, it leads to a reduction of inflammation. One of the major sources of chronic low-grade inflammation in our body is eating the toxic American diet, which is highly processed.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Osner, who is author of The Great American Heart Hoax and author of The Miami Mediterranean Diet. His website is drosner.com. That's drosner.com. And Dr. Osner is the Medical Director of Wellness and Prevention at Baptist Health South Florida and Medical Director of the Cardiovascular Prevention Institute of South Florida, and also a very popular, internationally known keynote speaker. It's just a real eye-opening book. I've talked with a number of cardiologists and read a number of books on it, and there's just a lot of things in here that I don't see anywhere else. It's amazing. We'll get back to Dr. Osner in just a moment. Note how old you feel now. You will soon feel a lot younger after hearing Dr. Bricky. That's how I'm usually introduced when I give a keynote address. We are brainwashed with limiting beliefs about aging. As America's preeminent anti-aging psychologist, I bring good news for a change. A change in how you view aging, and I do it with a good helping of humor. In short, I help audiences learn the mental game for living longer, healthier, and happier. But I'm not satisfied with people just acquiring information and having a feel-good time. I have people adopt healthier beliefs on the spot and lock them in for lifelong benefits. I also like to stay and do breakout sessions, consulting, and individual coaching at no additional cost. When your organization or business needs a speaker, have them check out my demo video at anti-aging-speaker.com. That's anti-aging-speaker.com. And give me a call. My phone number is on all my websites. And now back to Dr. Osner. Before we get into prevention, I had just a few more things that I wanted to ask you about. The last time I took my mother to her cardiologist, they had her see a different one, and I said, well, why isn't she seeing her regular cardiologist? And they said, oh, well, he's a plumber, and this is the electrician. That's how ingrained this pipe metaphor has become. And one of the things that really made sense to me as I was reading is one of the ways the pipe metaphor doesn't work is when there are minor blockages, cardiovascular system starts developing collateral arteries. I guess it's competition with the cardiologist that nature's trying to heal you itself.
And I talk about that in my book. What we know that nature, Mother Nature, does for us is as we develop these types of blockages that everybody fears, the so-called 90% blockage, our body is set up in such a way that when we have these significant blockages, we send out certain signals that open up what we term collateral blood vessels. These are blood vessels within the heart that lie dormant until they're needed, and the signal results in an opening up of these channels to then skirt around the blockage to provide blood flow to areas of the heart muscle that may not be getting adequate blood supply. It's like doing a bypass surgery on yourself, what we call an auto bypass. As a result, this is another reason why we have not seen benefit from a lot of the intervention that we're doing. We're fighting Mother Nature. So I think that is a factor that really should be addressed and often is not, as well as the fact that I feel that we should really be sitting down with our patients who might need to have a procedure and really addressing with them alternatives. I don't see that being done very often. As I see patients who said, well, gee, I had an episode of chest discomfort. The next thing I know, I'm in the cath lab and I'm being told that I need to have a stent or a bypass operation. And these were not unstable patients. And I said, well, what other alternatives were you given? And they say, we weren't. I think that's wrong. I think that what we need to do is sit down with patients. I think men and women have the right to understand that they were given informed consent and told that, well, we have two ways of treating this blockage. We have one way, which we'll call the intervention way. We could do a bypass or we could put in a stent, and we have no data to support that you're going to live a day longer or have fewer heart attacks if we put you through these procedures, and they have major risk associated with them and major expense associated with them. Or we could put you on a healthy diet, exercise program, stress management, lower inflammation and cholesterol in your body. You can certainly do these things that really cost very little, have essentially no side effect. What would you rather do, Ms. Jones or Mr. Smith? I can assure you the patient would opt for the less aggressive approach. But if they're not given that, if they're simply told that they're a walking time bomb, you know what they're going to choose.
And what some patients are getting, not only just the 5-minute explanation, but also, well, if you leave the hospital now, it'll be against medical advice and your insurance may not pay for your stay here.
Yeah, that, unfortunately, that's true as well.
I've seen a few photographs of the collateral arteries, and they were very tiny. Do they eventually get big enough to handle the workload that the previous artery was handling?
Yes, that's why we often find people, not uncommon, been well chronicled in the literature, people that have a 90-95% blockage and have no symptoms. They have no symptoms because these collateral vessels take over. Also been well chronicled that people actually can completely close down an artery, and there's no evidence that they ever had an episode of chest pain or a heart attack because of the collateral channels. And I think this brings up another good point. The reason why the smaller blockages are much more, the highly inflamed smaller blockages are much more dangerous, is because when they suddenly rupture, a 10% blockage, for instance, ruptures, and then the artery clots off within a matter of seconds, the body doesn't have time to develop these collateral vessels as they would in a different scenario of the blockage, that some blockages just gradually build up over time and where you do get develop collaterals. So that, again, is the reason why most of the cases of sudden cardiac death and heart attacks occur in people who have small plaques. Again, these are like pimples in the artery wall that suddenly rupture. A perfect example of that was the famous reporter Tim Russert. Tim Russert had no prior symptoms before his fatal event. We know what happened to Tim Russert. He ruptured a small plaque and then clotted off the artery in a matter of seconds and dropped dead. Unfortunately, this happens every 30 seconds in the United States. And what's unfortunate about it is that it's a preventable disease.
One more comment that is one of those, I haven't seen it anywhere else. You said with bypass surgery, sometimes people say, oh, it's so wonderful, I'm not having as much chest pain. And you say that can be because the pain receptors got severed when they were cutting open the chest.
That's right. We understand that some of the individuals who report being pain-free afterwards, it's not always because they have improved blood flow. Clearly, I want to give cardiac surgery its due. Some patients, in fact, do get improved blood flow and can get relief of their chest pain because of that. But we also know that in some instances, and this has been reported in the literature, it may well be because of the surgery itself ends up, you sever certain nerves and you lose those pain receptors. I think that, again, for the patients that are unstable, certain conditions like those that we call left main coronary artery disease, people that have intractable chest pain, they just can't with their life because of their severe chest pain, those individuals are the ones that do benefit from bypass surgery or for their interventional modalities like angioplasty and stents. Unfortunately, the majority of patients in the United States that are getting these procedures are not in that group. They're stable individuals.
Let's move to prevention, and you have, as you said, 10 points, and we're not going to have time to do all 10. Certainly exercise is extremely well documented in the last few years on how helpful it is for heart patients. But the one that you've focused the most on and have the most expertise on is what we eat. Can you tell me what you had for breakfast today or on a typical day?
Well, sure. I will have a bowl of oatmeal. I'll throw some blueberries in it, may have some fresh fruit. It's easy to eat healthy, and what is very interesting, I have found that the food is absolutely delicious. The reason why the Mediterranean diet has been around as long as it has is it's very palatable, probably more so than all these other diets that come and go on a regular basis. Again, the Mediterranean diet has survived the test of time. And what we understand is that, again, one of the hallmarks of the Mediterranean diet is the fact that it's non-processed. It's eating from the earth and eating from the sea, and clearly what we understand is that when we start eating this kind of dietary pattern, what we realize is that inflammation in our body goes way down. But we don't have enough time for me to quote all the studies to show that a Mediterranean diet radically reduces a person's risk of developing type 2 diabetes, significantly lowers the risk of developing heart attacks and strokes. The study out of Columbia Presbyterian in New York showing a 68% reduction in the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, a significant reduction of the risk of developing cancer, and I could go on and on and on. Remember, a lot of the common thread to a lot of these diseases is chronic low-grade inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're lowering inflammation, thereby decreasing disease state. Remember also that there's a term that we use called free radicals. Free radicals are these unstable molecules that travel around our body, damaging DNA, leading to cancer, oxidizing cholesterol, leading to heart disease. And these free radicals can be neutralized by antioxidants. And antioxidants really that come from eating a wide variety of different colored fruits and vegetables is our best defense against neutralizing these very toxic and harmful free radicals that are a result of not only a toxic American diet, but also a toxic American lifestyle. Smoking cigarettes, breathing in pollution, exposure to pesticides, too much ionizing radiation from the procedures like CAT scans that we talked about that really don't need to be done in the stable individual. So I understand is that nutrition is of critical importance. But I don't want to underestimate the powerful role that other areas in lifestyle intervention play. One of the forgotten risk factors is stress.
Mm-hmm.
And what we know is that stress has really been kind of poo-pooed often as a risk factor, cardiovascular risk factor. I say that stress is one of the most important risk factors. We, as early man, were designed to have what we call the fight or flight response, where we're walking and all of a sudden a saber-toothed tiger jumps out in front of us. We needed that fight or flight stress response in order to either fight the tiger or flee. And it was an outpouring of adrenaline, and it got us ready for battle. Unfortunately, today, modern man is not fighting saber-toothed tigers. We're fighting marital stress, job stress, day-to-day stress. And this fight-or-flight response occurs at least 20 or 30 times a day. So the average person is under constant heightened alert. We're pouring out catecholamines, which are adrenaline and noradrenaline. It also activates the stress response, activates the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, leading to an outpouring of glucocorticoids. These are steroid hormones that can lead to insulin resistance and contribute to the atherosclerotic disease process. So at the end of the day, the chronic stress, which is going to be the result of anxiety, depression, social isolation, hostility, all of these things lead to an outpouring of adrenaline, an outpouring of corticosteroids, which increase our likelihood of heart disease because they make our platelets more sticky, we're more apt to clot, they have a negative impact on our cholesterol panel, making our cholesterol more atherogenic. They certainly cause our arteries to constrict and raise our blood pressure and do lead to a whole host of negative consequences that culminate in heart attacks and strokes.
So of the 10 solutions you have, probably the biggest three, and particularly on an ongoing basis, are exercise, what we eat, and managing stress.
Well, I'd like to put in number four, smoking cessation as well.
Okay. That one I think everybody's heard. I want to get back to the Mediterranean diet. Is there a difference in emphasis in the Miami Mediterranean diet that you wrote about versus the Mediterranean diet in general?
That's a good question. You know, when I wrote this book, I got to tell you that when I went to medical, I must confess, I didn't take the first class in nutrition. I knew nothing about nutrition. And in the early days, and I'm going to turn the clock back over 20 years, when I got back to Miami to do my cardiology fellowship, balloon angioplasty, as I mentioned, was the thing. And one night after getting home, after treating a number of patients with heart attacks in the emergency room and doing balloon angioplasty, I flopped down after literally, it was 1 o'clock in the morning, I haven't eaten all day, and my wife's making dinner, and I pick up one of my medical journals, open it right to the page where Dr. Ansel Keys wrote a landmark study called the Seven Country Study. And basically what he found was that if you lived in the Mediterranean basin, and followed a Mediterranean diet, you had a 90% less likelihood of having a heart attack compared to your middle-aged American counterpart. I was so excited about this, I called my wife over and I said, stop making dinner. This doctor has gotten better results with a knife and a fork than I am with all my catheters. And honestly, I haven't looked back since that time. And the more research that I've conducted over the last 20 years, the more convinced I was that Dr. Ansel Keys was 100% correct, that clearly our flawed nutritional approach, the highly processed food that I've been talking about, is one of the major culprits. And I called it the Miami Mediterranean diet because it is a traditional Mediterranean diet, but we're fortunate because over the last 50 years we've had advances in nutritional science that has led to the introduction of healthy buttery spreads that are plant sterol and stanol spreads that are available to us. Pomegranate, which is kind of difficult to eat pomegranates, but now we have pomegranate juice. And all of these things, which I've included into my book, which weren't available, of course, hundreds or not thousands of years ago in the traditional Mediterranean diet. So the Miami Mediterranean diet is the traditional Mediterranean diet, which I tweaked with advances in nutritional science that really has given us ways of preparing food that is easy to prepare, that's delicious, and most importantly, that provides optimal health.
One of the amazing things I read was that it has better results than the American Heart Association diet. What does the American Heart Association diet recommend, and how did the Mediterranean diet beat it?
Well, this was a landmark trial called the Lyon Heart Trial in Lyon, France. And it compared the Mediterranean diet versus the Step 1 American Heart Association diet. And what they found was that there was a 70% reduction in mortality of those people following a Mediterranean diet versus the American Heart Association diet, and a 73% reduction in cardiovascular events. Major separation in the two. And what we realized is that the American Heart Association diet really still had too much saturated fat. It clearly still had the processed foods. It didn't have the emphasis that the Mediterranean diet had on fruits and vegetables and whole grains instead of processed grains. And I think that the American Heart Association years ago declared war on fat. That was their one of their major campaigns. But what they didn't realize years ago was that there's actually good types of fat that we need for good health. All fat cannot be considered to be bad. We know that omega-3 fat, for instance, is essential fatty acids that we need for optimal health. So that what we also have learned is that saturated fat and trans fat really are the bad types of fat that we need to avoid. And I think that's where the Mediterranean diet really, I think, has had an advantage over the American Heart Association diet in not stating that all fats are bad. In fact, 40% of their calories was through fat, but it was the good fat. It was the cold water fish. It was the extra virgin olive oil, which, by the way, let me add that olive oil is a misconception. It should be consumed in moderation. A lot of people think that a Mediterranean diet is pouring olive oil all over their food.
If it's good, more is better, yes.
That's right. That's not how it should be used. The operative word is drizzle. Utilize it, drizzle it on salads and vegetables. But I think that, in fairness to the American Heart Association, they have realized the power of the Mediterranean diet and have changed their dietary recommendations to be more in line with what we know to be a Mediterranean-style diet.
And in terms of supplements, I gather that if a person was to take just a few, your recommendation would be a multiple vitamin, some fish oil, maybe CoQ10, and possibly magnesium?
Well, let me talk about supplements for a minute, because there's a misconception here that I want to correct, and that is that people often have told me, well, I don't like fruits and vegetables. I just want to package it. You know, there's these stores, health food stores, that you could get the vitamins and vegetables in a pill.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, no, that is wrong. See, Mother Nature has done a much better job than we were ever able to do in packaging all of the thousands upon thousands of free radical fighting antioxidants that occur in nature. We've never been able to package that into a pill. In fact, often what we see is the vitamin companies teasing out a single antioxidant, example being lycopene, which is in tomatoes. Well, yes, lycopene is an antioxidant, and it's helpful. But if you take a tomato and you start analyzing the antioxidants in tomatoes, there are literally thousands upon thousands of antioxidants beyond just lycopene. And many of them we haven't even discovered yet. But at the end of the day, what nature has provided us is a wonderful way of all of these antioxidants work in concert with one another to give us good health. As an example, different antioxidants work at different layers of the cell. Some work at the middle of the cell to protect the DNA and the nucleus. Other antioxidants work at the cell membrane. So I say that it's really, if you want good health, don't look for it in a pill. Look for it in a wide variety of fresh fruits and vegetables of all different colors. Now, I have no problem if somebody wants to take a one-a-day multiple vitamin that doesn't have to fill in, for instance, some nutritional gaps that they may not get from eating a healthy diet. I have no problem with that. I think the problem is where people were taking mega doses of a specific vitamin. That really has not panned out. Say that, again, a healthy diet is our best source of minerals and vitamins and phytonutrients. As far as another supplement which can be helpful is fish oil. Omega-3 supplementation. Clearly, you can get ample amount of omega-3 if you eat cold water fish, such as salmon, a couple times a week. But for some people who don't, or people that have high triglycerides, we utilize fish oil frequently in order to lower cardiovascular risk. We also know that low-dose aspirin is a supplement that can be worthwhile. We know that for primary prevention, that's prevention of a heart attack in somebody who's never had a heart attack, that men over the age of 40 and women over the age of 65 can benefit by taking low-dose aspirin. Interestingly, in women, it's to prevent stroke more so than heart attack. Mm. But let me point out, before people start taking low-dose aspirin, 81 milligram aspirin, so-called baby aspirin, always check with your doctor first. If you obviously have a bleeding ulcer, if you have a platelet problem that may contraindicate aspirin, an allergy to aspirin, naturally, you shouldn't be taking aspirin. And I'll also say that anybody who is at what we call secondary prevention, these are people who have had heart attacks or strokes, or who have vascular disease, or even people with diabetes, and, you know, type 2 diabetes, they're more at risk for heart attacks. Aspirin is recommended. Again, check with your doctor first. And which brings up another good point while I'm on the line of checking with your doctor. I've always said that the optimal approach in preventing the number one killer in this country, which is cardiovascular disease, heart attacks and strokes, is to get educated, listen to programs like this, read books, but then have an ongoing relationship with your personal treating physician to discuss all prevention strategies before you get sick. Often many people feel that they're going to wait until they have a problem and then they call their doctor. Certainly, and unfortunately, often they waited too long because, unfortunately, as this disease of cardiovascular disease often strikes like a rattlesnake, it could lead to sudden cardiac death. But having an ongoing relationship, discussing nutritional plans, the prevention plans that we're discussing, exercise, smoking cessation, stress management, lowering inflammation, and the like, I think is the winning strategy.
One more question. This is something I'm confused about. We went through a period where everything was cholesterol, and then, well, cholesterol's overemphasized, and then you cited the Framingham study in the 150 Club that anybody who was in the study who had a cholesterol level overall of less than 150 didn't have cardiovascular problems. I read some of the alternative literature that suggests that once you get below 150 or so, you're not getting enough cholesterol to build the hormones, to replace cells. Is there some point where you can get too low?
Well, I'm sure there is. However, in the average American, that clearly is not the problem. And this has been well studied. I mean, what we know is that lower is better as it relates to LDL cholesterol. Now, there's a lot of confusion about cholesterol, because remember, there's a good cholesterol circulating in our body too, called HDL, high density lipoprotein. It's the bad type of cholesterol that the LDL cholesterol, where lower is better. And what we know is that certainly having, what is the optimal cholesterol? Well, the optimal total cholesterol probably is 130 to 150. The optimal bad cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, is probably 50 to 70. We know that from populations around the world that are hunter-gatherer type of populations, and they don't suffer from the major disease in the Western civilized countries that is the number one killer, cardiovascular disease. They have these low cholesterols, and we know that people with low cholesterol by diet and exercise, they do not have an increased risk of cancer. They don't have a problem with having enough cholesterol to make steroid hormones and the beneficial impact of cholesterol. Cholesterol has a good role, too. As you mentioned, you need it for steroid hormone synthesis. You need it for cell membranes. But what we know is that in our affluent society, we have clearly the problem of having too much cholesterol as a result of our lifestyle, over nutrition, as well as not enough exercise. And as a result, this excess cholesterol gets deposited in the arterial wall. And when that happens, it gets oxidized and it kicks off the process we're talking about. Now, clearly, if rare occasions where we see somebody with a total cholesterol that's extremely low, less than 100, those are special situations. They're very, very rare. But those are situations where, as with anything, it's like blood pressure. Lower is better, but you can have too low a blood pressure, too. Same with blood sugar. So I think that our problem across America is not the fact that we have too low a cholesterol. Our problem is that we have too much bad cholesterol floating around our bloodstream, which is a direct result of a highly processed, toxic American diet, which is calorie-dense, nutrient-depleted, and overly processed. In addition to the fact we don't exercise adequately, and when we don't exercise, we clearly tend to gain weight. We have low amounts of circulating HDL, which is the good cholesterol. Our blood sugar tends to go up because of the fact that we develop an insulin resistance syndrome and metabolic syndrome. And I think that literally we can right the ship by living a proper lifestyle. And for those that can't get the goal despite diet and exercise and lifestyle changes, that's where we have very good medications to be utilized when needed.
Mm-hmm.
Let me make a point about medications, because everybody has heard about the cholesterol-lowering medicine, the statin pills that are out there. Often I hear patients come into my office and say, now, Dr. Osner, can't I just take this statin medicine that was advertised on television and then I could eat whatever I want because it's going to lower my cholesterol? And my answer is absolutely no. The studies have shown that you get the biggest bang for the buck by lowering your cholesterol by following a prudent diet, not by taking a pill. In other words, medications such as statin medicines that lower cholesterol, in addition to, not in place of, a healthy lifestyle. For those people that have a genetic predisposition to a very high cholesterol or people who have had heart attacks, clearly, medications like statins can have been very worthwhile if utilized properly in addition to lifestyle changes. Unfortunately, too many people think that it is a substitute for a healthy lifestyle.
Well, we all want a pill that exercises for us, lets us eat all that we want, whatever we want. It's not going to happen. We've been talking with Dr. Michael Osner, the author of The Great American Heart Hoax. I absolutely love this book. It's an eye-opener with lots of information that I don't see anywhere else. And author of The Miami Mediterranean Diet. The website is drosner.com, just drosner.com. I also know that Dr. Osner is the symposium director for the annual Cardiovascular Disease Prevention Symposium, an annual international meeting that is the premier forum for cardiovascular disease prevention. And Dr. Osner, thank you so much. I love what you're doing, and this is really important stuff.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being on your program.
Commentary. Dr. Osner is very polite and doesn't go for the jugular, but the truth is that cardiac surgery is a $60 billion industry that is the star and major profit center of most hospitals. Medicine is increasingly emphasizing evidence-based procedures. If medicine uses evidence-based criteria with cardiac surgery, it will kill the golden goose. It's amazing that while the data has been around for decades, cardiologists continue to urge angioplasties and bypass surgeries, despite their not having any better results than conservative medical treatment in most cases. I'm surprised that Dr. Osner's colleagues haven't tried to tar and feather him for threatening their lucrative practices. I've been trying to sort out how different experts and organizations are emphasizing different causes of cardiovascular disease. In rejecting the plumbing analogy for cardiovascular disease, Dr. Osner's book describes a process that leads to cardiovascular disease. The process starts with excess LDL cholesterol burrowing into the artery walls, joining triglycerides, oxidizing, and prompting inflammation and its aftermath. An intervention at any stage of this process can help. Thus, lowering LDL cholesterol helps, raising HDL cholesterol helps, lowering triglycerides helps, antioxidants help, balancing omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids help, good nutrition helps, exercise helps, lowering stress helps. Unchecked, the ultimate process becomes inflammation, which is not only the key to cardiovascular disease, but also to most chronic diseases. For those who resist following regimes, the basic principles of the Mediterranean or Miami Mediterranean diet are simple. Lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, nuts, whole grains, lean protein, especially from small cold water fish such as salmon, and eschewing processed food. I also know that Dr. Osner's emphasis on stress nicely reinforces the show we did with cardiologist Dr. Joel Ochsner and cardiac psychologist Dr. Jerry Corfine. Overall, I think The Great American Heart Hoax is the most important cardiology book of the century. Hopefully, it'll be a wake-up call for having cardiology becoming more evidence-based and more holistic. Baby steps. I always like to leave you with some little tweak in your behavior that advances our goal of living longer, healthier, and happier. And my baby step today is simply that each meal, ask yourself, how well does what you're eating now fit with the Mediterranean diet principles? Now, that doesn't mean you can never have a slice of cheesecake, but the mere act of asking yourself the question encourages you to eat more healthily. I'd love to hear from you. Send your emails to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@agelesslifestyles.com. To subscribe to my free email newsletter, the Defy Aging Newsletter, or for information on my books, Defy Aging and 52 Baby Steps to Grow Young, or my very unique anti-aging hypnosis CDs, just go to drbricke.com, that's drbricke.com, or you can go to my portal site, notaging.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricke, on webtalkradio.net, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.